Welcome to this episode of My Journey as a Physicist. This episode, we're joined by Dr. Raul Briceño, an assistant professor at Old Dominion University, as well as a staff member at Jefferson Lab. Welcome, Dr. Briceño. Could you briefly introduce yourself? What is your position and role, and what kind of work do you do?
I'm an assistant professor at Old Dominion University in the physics department. I'm also a staff scientist at Jefferson Lab, which is part of the National Labs of the Department of Energy out here in Virginia. My research focuses on theoretical nuclear physics. So in the lab, even though it's an experimental facility, I am part of the theory center, and so which hosts faculty from adjacent universities. That's where I carry out my research.
So what kind of like specific research do you do? You said theoretical nuclear. Can you get like a little more detailed?
Sure. Yeah. So I work on lattice quantum chromodynamics. So quantum chromodynamics is a theory that describes the interactions between quarks and gluons, which we understand to be the fundamental particles of that make up all atomic nuclei. So atomic nuclei, of course, are made out of protons and neutrons, which are combined together to form, you know, to form either helium, carbon, oxygen, all the way through the periodic table. These building blocks, namely protons and neutrons, are themselves made out of other particles called quarks and gluons. And the theory that describes their interaction at a fundamental level is called quantum chromodynamics, the word chromo referring to color. So I study that theory, which is, unlike many theories that we typically study in physics, is non-perturbative in nature, meaning all the perturbative tools that you build and learn about in quantum mechanics failed to describe it in general. It turns out that perturbation theory is quite useful in some energy regions. So for very high energies, it still remains to be useful. But for most energies, it turns out to just not be useful. And so we resort to numerical tools, the most powerful of which is called lattice quantum chromodynamics, which for short, we can just call it lattice QCD. And this is a tool. What it does is that it rewrites space and time as a mesh. So we discretize the space as well as time. And this allows us to then represent all the mathematical objects that appear inside of a theory as matrices, which we can then proceed to manipulate using linear algebra tricks. And so this is a great representation for numerical evaluation. And this is now useful because of the development of supercomputer facilities. And so we can use supercomputing facilities to evaluate QCD observables using this tool, lattice QCD. And so I work in that line of research.
So I just kind of like want to, you know, like really hit home one little point. You said you do theoretical research. And in my mind, you know, the first thing I think of is, okay, you're at a chalkboard and you're doing mathematical equations, you know, formalisms like that. But you said you do a lot of numerical work. So it's like theoretical physics, you know, working out equations or kind of doing more simulation type based work?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think people like to think about theory as just being pen and paper work. These days, theory involves, you know, it goes everything from pen and paper work to the use of computers, anything from your laptop to supercomputers. Even now these days to, possibly using quantum computers as well. That being said, I am in a numerically heavy field. So lattice QCD is, by definition, relies in the use of numerical tools. But despite that, I do end up spending most of the time doing pen and paper physics. So I do work on developing new mathematical formalisms that allows us to study new classes of nuclear reactions using lattice QCD. So although I do some work on the computer and I do, you know, various different types of calculations and analysis using computers, I definitely spend more than 50% of my time deriving new equations that allow us to study nuclear reactions, properties of subatomic particles, using Lattice QCD that were previously inaccessible, if that makes sense.
So you mentioned that you have appointment at Jefferson Lab. So I imagine there's a lot of people there working in various ways. But your like actual research project or work that you do, like how big of a team is it? Primarily just you? Do you have like a group of other colleagues that you work with, or grad students, or other people? Like how big is working on this particular project?
Yeah. So the Theory Center at JLab is the largest single nuclear theory group in the nation, or in within the Department of Energy. So there's people, there are folks from different institutions as well as Jefferson Lab itself. Within there, I work directly, so I collaborate with a few staff members, but I'm also part of an international collaboration, which is called the Hadron Spectrum Collaboration. For short, we call it HADSPEC. And there's three of us at JLab that are members of this collaboration. The rest of the collaboration is largely in Europe and other institutions, Cambridge, Trinity College, Edinburgh. And so I work with these folks, but we all work together to share software tools, acquire time in supercomputers to be able to do our runs. And so we share intellectual property with each other to be able to make our calculations more efficient. Within each project, we may not all be involved in that project, but we all talk to each other. We maintain constant communication. So I work with some folks at JLab, but then I also work with folks around the world as well.
So kind of like going back earlier in time, when did you decide or realize that you wanted to, be a physicist, or when did you get interested in physics?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I've always been interested in math since I was little. I just always had a knack for it. And I like the sciences. I didn't really learn about physics until I was in high school. At the time, I kind of was debating between, I was really interested in philosophy and art at the time. And math just was still something that I just did for naturally. Then I started learning about physics, and I just kind of felt my attraction. The thing that drew me into philosophy started drawing me into physics. Then I went to college, keeping an open mind, taking classes about, basically all the sciences, and eventually just narrowed down for me. I felt, at some point my love for math kind of reached a limit, and it started to become too abstract. And then I was like, okay, that's enough. and then my love for other fields in, the sciences like chemistry and biology, those dwindled away quite quickly. And so I just kind of honed in my attraction into physics, and theoretical physics is, it's applied math essentially. I mean, that's what I do. It's just like an applied mathematician towards physics problems. And that just seems like the perfect nook for me. And you're asking interesting questions about, the nature of the building blocks of matter. And so I don't know, it just seemed to satisfy all my needs and, my strengths, which was the mathematical side, and my, more philosophical desire. So it's just kind of, it was like the perfect middle path for me.
Okay. Yeah. Very, very interesting. Are you still interested in art or the philosophy, or do you engage with those in any way currently?
Yeah. I mean, I kept doing painting. So painting was my media. So oil painting, I kept doing painting up until grad school. And then after that, during grad school, and then afterwards, it started to become increasingly hard. I still have a painting up that I'm like halfway through I just put it up to guilt me into working on it. So there's that. So I still do that. And philosophy, I still read some philosophy books, but mostly like pop philosophy, right? Like, books by philosophy professors who like will digest philosophy for you in a way that is accessible. So I still do that for fun. So
when you were like an undergraduate student, did you know that you wanted to be like a researcher or, you know, go to grad school? Did you have like a set kind of career path in mind?
No, I mean, I joked that my mom, she was an economist. She always said, you know, you had to go get a doctor, you know, you have to get a PhD because you need to get a title that is higher than mine. So there was like always a little bit of pressure from her, but that's not real. I mean, the truth is that the path was, you know, it was always uncertain, right? Like I was always not sure where I was going to be. And I was never really sure if I was going to make it. And so it was just like, it just ended up being one step at a time, right? So I started going to college, and, you know, going to college was overwhelming because you're like surrounded by a bunch of brilliant people, and you're like, you know, at least for me, like I had never been around so many smart people at once. And so that's already like, it always, shoots down your, you know, sense of worth, or like, you know, it makes you insecure. And so, you know, by having the right mentors and the right connections, I was able to like stick it through. And then going to grad school was the same story, right? You know, then you're going to another layer of folks, and you're going to be increasingly smart and interesting people. And so it's, you know, it always takes a little bit of a jab at your confidence. But for me, you know, the thing that like, when it was like, you know, when it would eat away a little bit of my confidence is make me work harder. So I think, I ended up working harder every single time, and having the right mentors, and you know, I was able to make it through. But I didn't really have a plan going forward. I mean, I ended up going into I didn't even know. The reality was that when I went to grad school, I didn't consider nuclear physics as an option. I was really interested in particle theory. And then I started learning what nuclear physics was, and I was like, okay, that's more attractive to me. And I started going in that direction. But I don't know. I didn't really have like a set plan. I just kept going along with it, and it just ended up working out.
Did you ever consider like going into an industry at all? Or did you kind of just stick in this researcher academic path?
I never fantasized about going into industry. Most of my friends in grad school ended up going into industry. I kept always fantasizing about, you know, pursuing something completely different, right? Like if it didn't work out for me, you know, like there was like moments, I lived in Seattle. So like, I was like, wow, I could just become a barista, you know, like I just had like a whole different random path. Fantasy. So, but no, I don't think I could have done fine in industry, but it was never the kinds of things that I was like fantasizing about. If I would have left academy, I think I would have taken some time off to figure out what I wanted to do. But I know that opportunity was there, and it's worked out for most of my classmates, and you know, they're doing great.
When you were going through this career path, are there any obstacles that you feel comfortable sharing that you may have had to overcome?
I think for me, the hardest parts for me were dealing with the insecurity of whether I was going to cut it. Going from classes to research was very challenging for me. I had a advisor who was like has really high standards, and that, you know, which is great for research. And it was really hard adjusting to that. And so that took me a long time to be able to acclimate from going to a classmate, you know, from taking classes where you know there's a right answer, and what you essentially have to do is reproduce it, and you can go through the work. But then going from there to being able to construct an answer that, no, you know, construct even the question, like begin by defining a question, a well-defined question that nobody has asked before, making sure that nobody's answered that question, making sure that that question is interesting, and then trying to find a solution to that question. That was remarkably challenging. That was perhaps the hardest time for me academically, even if I look back at undergrad, I always felt, you know, I was being challenged and in all instances. I mean, I think that is the case for most people, but you're also far away from home, right? So you're on your own. And for me, literally home was, I had some family in the States, but like my real home is in Venezuela. So it was even further, you know, than some people. So there's, you're alone and you're trying to like, you're going through this procedure that is mentally and emotionally challenging, and you're trying to like make it through. And for undergrad, it was mostly fine, especially because like I had a good cohort, and you know, I would make sure to have fun whenever possible. Grad school, at least the middle years. You know, my early years, you're taking classes, you're getting your behind kicked, if you want to put it that way, but you're with everybody, right? And so it's like a boot camp and everybody's in it together, right? Everybody's working hard and you're like trying to make it through classes and you're helping each other out. But then comes this period where like you start now going from that, where you have the support system of your students, to going into something alone. And then all that, you know, whatever insecurities you had, just eat at you, right? And for me, my first paper took close to somewhere around 2 years, and even longer. And at that point, it wasn't clear that I was going to be able to make it. So I was that was the hardest time, because it was just, I was like, what am I doing? There's so much pain and there's no reward, right? And research, a lot of it is painful, but there is like an element of reward when you figure things out, right? And if you don't see that, if you're in that period where you're like a year or two goes by and you never see the reward, you know, it's not an easy task.
So at the moment, do you want either teach classes, or do you have like graduate students that work with you?
Yes.
Or undergrad?
Yes to all of that. So I teach. I've been at ODU for 4 years. I've taught the first 3 years intro physics. This last year I took, I taught quantum field theory, which is a second year grad course. I have several grad students that are working with me, a handful, let's say. And then I have a few undergrads that are working with me at different levels. I even have a high school student that's working with me.
Very cool. I was just kind of curious of, you know, I sort of understand, like, oh, yes, we go from this process of, you know, how we're more or less taught how to learn during classes or answer questions or whatnot, and how that's kind of very different when you transition into research. I was just kind of curious, like, you know, what advice or like skills that you help your students, you know, to kind of overcome some of like these obstacles that maybe you experienced, like help better prepare them?
Yeah. I mean, I think, what is it, like a good artist borrows, a great artist steals. Is that the phrase? I can't remember. But like everything I know is essentially like I look at other people and I see how they do it. And so I've seen some good mentors. I've seen like a range of different advisors and mentors through the years. And without naming names, I think, you know, one that I've seen that I think is absolutely great, my impression is that what he does with students is that he'll, you know, the first paper, he will essentially lead the paper and let the student catch up. Right. And then like the student like learns, you know, basically reproduces what the mentor has done. On the second paper, they're kind of neck and neck, you know, they're doing like work simultaneously, and, you know, they meet every day or however often and be like, what did you get? Right. And then at the later stages in the student's career, and here I'm thinking about a grad student, right? You let them lead the way. And then you're the one that is like following behind. And so I'm trying to follow something similar with my students. Depending on the circumstances, at least with grad students, I try to follow that, where like I introduce them into a project where I know it's going to lead to something, or I've worked out enough that I'm several steps ahead. I know that it's not an outrageous question, and it's, you know, it would more likely be something that I'm already working on, so that they see what I'm doing and how I'm doing it and how I'm writing my notes, and so that they can start mimicking. And then at later stages, then, you know, it'll be a little more, you know, even, you know, perhaps I'll lead one part and then the student leads another part. And later on, hopefully they can at least lead one project before they get off, you know, into the real world. With younger students, it's essentially the same. So it's, especially with even younger students, there's even less of a risk. So you can let them wander in something that is, you know, you don't want to make them wander in a direction that is totally useless, right? But you can let them, you know, play a little bit, right? Because there's low stakes, right? And so, meaning in grad school, you have a very, you know, tight period in terms of when you have to, you know, the expectations of what you should achieve in, you know, in some set of years. In undergrad, if you have a paper out, that's amazing, right? And so that's a huge achievement. And so if you, instead of writing a paper, you wander into a direction, you figure out, like, this is the thing for me and this is not the thing for me, either way, it's a success. So.
Okay. Yeah, that all makes sense. So that you taught classes and you do your research, I'm kind of curious, what does like a typical day or like a typical week kind of look like for you with all your different responsibilities?
Yeah, these days is, so we haven't even touched on the thing that perhaps is consuming a lot, well, I don't know if most of my time, but quite a bit of my time, which is outreach stuff. So I also work on, I co-lead several outreach programs, and one of them is about to launch for its second phase this summer. And so these days, a lot of meetings. So the meetings will be either about outreach stuff, or so in the summertime, I'm mostly just meeting about outreach stuff or research. And so I'll meet with, on the research side, what I do with students is that I have different pockets of research topics. And so I've been working on, so if I get more specific, so various different things related to lattice QCD. So I'm either doing some calculations that are what we actually are doing runs in supercomputers, or we're driving new mathematical formalisms on different things. And so I'll meet with those subgroups once a week, and we'll talk about our progress. So I would have done something, they would have done something. And then at one point, what I do is that I grab all the subgroups and we meet once a week, say on Monday. So yesterday we met all of the subgroups, all the students together, all the postdocs and students and me together. And then some of them report to everybody. So they practice speaking about their research, not just to me, but also to others, right? And so the idea is that, like, and also that way, all of them stay informed about what others are doing. So they learn, like, some of them might be, you know, writing some software, the other ones might be driving some mathematical equations, and they get to talk to each other and hear what they're doing and ask each other questions, so that there's, you know, it extends beyond their own research. And so they feel like they're part of a team, and they're also learning more. So these days I'm in a lot of virtual meetings, but then I will try to dedicate a few hours of hopefully a day to research on my own. So I might be, you know, on my iPod or writing some code, writing some paper.
Can you talk a little bit about like the outreach work that you do?
Yeah, sure. So I started working as a postdoc at Jefferson Lab. And there, at some point, I started leading this program that we have with Mexico, where we bring, in collaboration with the University of Mexico, we bring a student from Mexico over the summer to do research at JLab. So at some point, I started leading this this partnership with Mexico locally. And so the student comes and then they do research over the summer. The student is they just graduated from undergrad. So they have some knowledge under their belt. So I started doing that and I continued to work on that. And at some point I created a summer course to teach students how to program. And this with physics in mind, and this is for high school students. So I went to high schools and started trying to promote the various different in-person events that we had at ODU. And then in that period, I realized there was a need for students to learn how to do scientific programming early on. And so we created a course. We called it Python for Physics because we teach them how to use Python. And then in that same time period, I created a program. I went to Puerto Rico to talk to schools there. And we created a program where we brought students from Puerto Rico to ODU, Jefferson Lab, and NASA, because NASA is close by. And so we gave them like a whole week experience in this area so they can get a sense of the opportunities that they have in the area. These were mainly high school students, some undergrad students. Then last year, the pandemic happened. And so these in-person programs that were over the summer, we had to cancel them. And so we decided to create a program that basically just took them all up. They just kind of absorbed them all and it went virtual. And this is called Remote Experience for Young Engineers and Scientists. And so if you grab the letters, it spells out Regis, which is quite clever, which I'm proud of, because it means kings in Spanish. And ODU, the symbol of ODU is the monarchs. So it's kind of cute. Kings, monarchs. Anyway. What we did is that we hosted over 80 virtual events with speakers from all over the world coming to tell students, basically, like, imagine like each person is given like a mini colloquium where they talk about their research and like the opportunities in their field or something that they like regarding the research. And so the students kind of get like this like survey of different fields. So they like, you know, they can hear about, you know, nuclear physics or, you know, astronomy or entomology or whatever. It's all the stems. It's not just physics. And so they get to learn what these words mean and what their careers could be, right? If they go in that direction, right? So that it makes their path less uncertain. And then on top of that, this class that I was teaching, Python for Physics, we moved it online. And we moved other classes, other classes that my colleagues teach online. And so we give them like a little bit of taste of different fields. And then we start training them and giving them tools for programming. We teach them some basics of engineering. This year, we're going to have a class where somebody's going to teach them how to make music with Python. So they're going to be able to like make their own beats and splice them and, you know, put them together to make music. This year, we're going to have the creator of the modern electronic microphone. So, you know, we've had astronauts come and speak. We've had one, we're about to have a second. So anyways, it's both inspirational, but also useful and fun. We're kicking off within this Regis program. We're also adding a mentoring program. So then that mentors from all over the world can match with mentees, students that are in high school or undergrad that are all over the world as well. So it's kind of like a matching site for scientists and students. And so this Regis program is kind of taking a life of its own, which is why it's consuming a lot of my time. But it's really like just something I love. It's so rewarding. So
that's amazing. You have like so many different things that are going on. That sounds really great. So then I guess I'm curious, you know, this is going to sound maybe like a very simple question, but like, why do you do this? Like, what do you get from this? What drives you?
It's like, it's many things. I mean, the bigger and loftier answer is that like, I think there's a huge disparity in the access to education in this country. I mean, I think that the educational system in the US is broken, to put it gently. And these so you have huge inequities on, you know, the opportunities that people have depending on which, you know, which side of a city they land in, right? Accidentally where they were born, right? And these inequities translate even more across the world, right? And so I think, you know, part of me wants to try to help to alleviate a little bit of that pressure and give, you know, seek the, provide more resources to those that need it the most. So there's that drive. And that's a lot of the programs that I've been involved in are aimed to towards increasing the representation of underrepresented groups in the sciences. So there's that. I know that Regis or any of these programs are not going to move that needle, right? They're not going to completely shift this, right? So it would be a little delusional if I thought that that was the case. But the things that these programs do, it makes outreach a contagious thing, right? You can see in the sense of like, you know, by the more that my colleagues and I talk about outreach, the more they're interested in working on it, the more likely that our students will want to be participating in it, the more that they will be educated about the issues that exist. And so that the much more that they can advocate for equitable education, and the more they can advocate for the sciences, right? And so it's a training. These programs serve a little bit to train us, the scientists and the experts, to be able to talk to non-experts and be able to advocate for the sciences and education as a whole. That's part of where, you know, that I am interested in. But I do think, even though I did say that, like, I understand, you know, I have a realistic sense that these things won't shift the needle completely, it does shift them for several people. And so we are trying to get students involved in research so that they get connections earlier on, so that they're much more likely to participate. And I think the fact that we have underrepresentation of certain groups in sciences, the root cause is in the high school system. Or in fact, I think it's earlier than that. And so I think these systems do need a shock so that we can start redirecting the talent, right? Because there's a tremendous amount of talent in you know, in these communities. And I'm thinking in particular, you know, the Hispanic and Black communities in the US, that like they're just shocked, you know, they're tremendously underrepresented in sciences. And so I think there's tremendous amount of talent that is just being redirected elsewhere, that, you know, we can start moving towards the sciences. And so that's part of what drives me, is trying to create these pathways, and at the same time, helping others to become, you know, better advocates. And I think it is possible. And I see it in my own students. Like last year, three of my students who I've published papers with all participated in Regis. They all wanted to dedicate their, you know, part of their time in the summer to, you know, train other students and tell them about the sciences. And this year, even more so. So I have even more students and now postdocs involved in it. So I think these things are, you know, I see the effect, right? I think it's and it's paying off.
That's really great work that you do. And like I could talk with you about that for a long time, but you know, for time right now to kind of wrap things up, you talked about this a little bit, but do you have any advice or tips of wisdom that you would give maybe students who are thinking about going into physics?
Yeah, I mean, I think first, I mean, if it is what you love, then by all means, go for it. Just like any other field, it is challenging to go into it. Physics, I mean, I at no point did I ever regret, and I think most people, I mean, I could, and most people that I know of, nobody's ever regretted going into physics. It is a very rewarding field. And the skill, you know, even I, when I was at some point thinking like I perhaps couldn't become a physicist, I was quite happy with everything, you know, like I did get to be able to learn a little bit about the history of, you know, this particular field, learn some, you know, get some insight into physics itself. And I knew that a lot of the skills that were developed that I was developing were going to be useful in other fields. And, you know, in fact, in so a few years ago, I know that LSAT and the highest LSAT scores, which is the ones that they exam for going into law school, the highest LSAT scores were physicists. And so, and, you know, it, basically, if you go into physics, there's almost 100% chance that you're going to land the job elsewhere, right? So, you know, what I would tell my, you know, people, and, you know, what I would tell myself, right, is that, you know, if you don't end up in physics, your consolation prize is going to be getting a job elsewhere that is probably going to be more, you know, slightly more higher pay, because there's such a demand for people that are that have the skill sets that physicists have. But I mean, you should only do it if you love it, because it's but I think that's the general truth. I mean, the reason why I went into physics and the reason why people go into physics, I think in general, is because they love the idea of being able to spend all day thinking about solving problems that, you know, nobody has solved before. And so if that's who you think you are, then by all means, go for it.
Yeah, I think that's really, really good advice. And it's, I've really enjoyed learning everything that you have to say and all the great work that you're doing. Thank you for coming on and doing this.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me. Yeah, it's a pleasure.